Okay, welcome everybody to the first Advocacy Sector Conversation for 2020. My name is Melissa Hayo and I'm the coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit, and thank you all for coming today. Our forum today is being held on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation, and I wish to acknowledge them as traditional owners. I would also like to pay my respect to their elders, past and present, and elders from other communities who may be here with us today. I would also like to welcome those of us who have joined online. Just a few little housekeeping things to sort out before we start today's forum. The toilets are on either side of me. The male toilets are to my right, and female to my left. Accessible toilet also to my left. Lunch will be at 12 to 1 and afternoon tea at 2 to 2:30. And really important today, with question time, make sure you wait for the microphones. Now, the reason for that is when there's a microphone, the people on live stream can hear you. And also, if you're on live stream today, there is a phone number on the screen that you can text to ask your questions, and I will ask them on your behalf. So let's just jump straight into it. I would like to introduce Tanya Sherwood, the Manager of Policy and Programs at Emergency Management at the DHHS. Hang on, my clicker's not working. And she will talk to us about Victoria's bushfire response and what's next. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melissa, and thank you all for having me here today. Andrea Spitieri, who was invited to talk today, passes on her sincere apologies. We're a little bit busy at the moment, and she very much wanted to be here but hasn't been able to make it. So please be patient with me, and it may well be that I can't answer every question, but we are very keen to hear all of the questions and take anything that we can't answer today on notice back with us to the department to respond to later. So first of all, just a little bit about the current situation and the work that we've been doing over the last month or 6 weeks. There's still 3 significant fires in Victoria, and the amount of hectares that have been affected and communities that have been affected are enormous, 1.5 million plus. The initial impact assessment data has told us that there are 405 residential and 653 non-residential structures, but we know that this number may well increase. Secondary impact assessments, which involve building surveyors, environmental health officers, and others visiting each property within the fire scar to verify the impacts to the property. Re-establishment payments are insurance and income tested. Ongoing air quality monitoring is part of what we're doing, and it remains a concern, and I would say water quality as well. The Victorian Bushfire Case Support Program, which provides a single point of contact for people who need help to understand and access supports available. We know that accessing supports or knowing where to go to is really complex in a situation like this, so we're trying to simplify that as much as possible. Support coordinators provide that single point of contact for those who need it and work with local residents to link them to the supports that they need. So there's a bit of information there on the case support program. Some of you may be familiar with that after the Bunyip fires at the start of last year, and we found that this is an easier way for community members to find the things that they need. We're in the process now of a transition between relief and recovery. We still have some relief activities. We know some communities still require relief services, such as resupply of food and essentials, and that there are some communities that are still cut off with road access or have limited access Malakuta just went back on mains power and just recently, so it's still a very slow process in some areas. But in other areas, we're moving to a recovery focus, and part of that transition involves the establishment of Bushfire Recovery Victoria. So Bushfire Recovery Victoria and the department are still focused on providing housing and accommodation. The community recovery committees are something that Bushfire Recovery Victoria will be leading, and doing so at a pace that is comfortable for communities and follows their needs. The cleanup has started, and that is also being led by Bushfire Recovery Victoria, which is a new permanent and dedicated agency to recovery. So that is still being built up. They're still trying to establish their processes and their staffing. Part of what they're also doing is managing the Bushfire Appeal Fund for Victoria. And I've put a link here to access if people want to have a look or contact them. Melissa, are any of these links here we can provide to anyone today? Great, thank you. So, separate to responding to the bushfires, but related to the work that we're doing, is some work that my colleague Deb, who's here today, is starting to put together. We're looking at increasing the resilience of people with disability in emergencies. This project to co-design a new model for engaging people to undertake emergency planning and what a model like that might look like. This is only just beginning, so we will certainly be coming back and asking for advice and for input all the way through. But I just wanted to flag that this is something that we're looking to do this year. Reviews and research, this comes up quite a bit, the evidence base, and so much of what we do is based on beyond bushfires and all of the learnings from 2009, including the Vulnerable People's Register, which came out of the Royal Commission into the 2009 fires. So we are also doing a review on the policy around vulnerable persons, and we're also looking at whether the experiences of the Vulnerable Persons Register during these fires and these events make it still fit for purpose, or how we could be considering vulnerability and responding to that. We're also waiting for papers that we believe are imminent to come out of Morwell. We understand there will be a difference between the event at Morwell. Every emergency event is different. But we hope that the work that has happened in Morwell to map secondary effects of an emergency event might provide us with a model for considering that in this event. We'll also follow up with researchers, including the group who have done Beyond Bushfires, but we know that there are other researchers like Claudia Mark that we will speak to about building that evidence base for how we support people in emergency events. These are some of the other areas for information that we can send out. Thank you, Melissa. And finally, what we're really keen to do is have a discussion with you all and to hear from you all. We know that advocacy groups are actively supporting families out in northeast and in East Gippsland in relief centres and moving into recovery support. And so we want to hear from them, and I'm looking at Adrian, but also how we can better support the work that you're doing. We're keen to understand better how the NDIA role in supporting clients during evacuations in Victoria, how it worked, and if there's any outcomes from this or these experiences that we can take back and work with you on improving. And we want to know about actions taken to ensure service continuity for NDIA participants. So that is a very short catch up on our situation, and I'm now keen to hear from you.
Thank you. Thank you for a brief presentation. I'm keen to get involved and to see where you're headed, particularly with ongoing consultation with people with disabilities, because I think we're a key cohort that's getting missed in emergency situations. I have three questions, I'm keen to hear more about information access in the bushfires, because there was not a lot of information given out across a variety of channels, including social media. Sometimes interpreters weren't always visible on screen, etc. I'm also keen to hear about Bushfire Recovery Victoria and if there are people with disabilities on that, and if they are key people leading this approach. And if there's any data being collected on the long-term health impacts of experiencing bushfires and emergencies, and also the impacts of not having access to medications or supports in an emergency situation. And where the responsibility lies, because there seems to be some confusion whether it is with the state government or whether participants should be looking to the NDIA. And as we know, the NDIA doesn't fund what-ifs in your plans, it only funds goals in your plans, and obviously an emergency is a what-if and not a goal. So I think there's some confusion around who should be providing Victorians with disabilities with key supports in emergency situations, and I think that should lie with the state government.
Thank you. I'll start with the quickest answer that I can give you, which is about Bushfire Recovery Victoria. At the moment, the only permanent staffing that we know of is the CEO. Everyone at the moment is temporary and for 3 months while they establish themselves. So I'm not sure what the staffing makeup is at this point, because as far as I know, they're still recruiting all of the time. And for a lot of those staff, it's just 3 month recruitment. So in terms of whether any staff with disability are involved in Bushfire Recovery Victoria or leading any of that work, I can't answer that, but what I would say is it's changing quite rapidly, the staffing profile there. And certainly that's something I'll bring back for Andrea to raise in the meetings that she has with Bushfire Recovery. So they've established a few committees and task forces to sort of set them up, and that will be raised. Information access is a really good question, and it's something that you would think we would collectively be better at. And I say collectively because this seems to be, it's such a crucial thing in an emergency. And for myself, I felt that we were getting better at it as a state. You know, the app that tells you about where things are and provides updates, that is certainly a big step forward compared to where we were in 2009. But there was, I think, this has not been the first time that it's been raised about a lack of accessible fact sheets or directions or information. So again, that is something we have dedicated communications resourcing, and it was raised by Bushfire Recovery Victoria already about what we have prepared in advance. There are some things we know that is going to be applicable to every event, and some things that can only be determined during an event because it's specific to that emergency, and how we can be more prepared for our communications. So that is something that is certainly being discussed and on the agenda, but it's something else we can take back as well. And it would be really good to hear what kind of communications you feel were missing or what would have been helpful, so that we can ensure that that's part of our review and evaluation. In terms of the long-term impacts, health impacts, I think that's something we're all... I don't believe we have a system that maps and measures that. And certainly that is something that's been raised by a lot of communities who are both affected by these bushfires, but also affected by the smoke. how we go about measuring that, that's why we're looking and waiting for the Morwell report, because I think that is one of the first events where they've really invested in trying to determine what those secondary impacts were. And I know that California has done some very good work on that exactly, on trying to map what the long-term health effects might be from these events and how we can quantify and capture those. So certainly that is something that we're interested in at a policy team level, and where we can work with researchers to start to put an approach for that together. Ordinarily, I'll just as an aside say, we would work with our health protection colleagues and public health colleagues to do that, but at the moment they're very focused on coronavirus. So that might be a conversation that we have a little bit later in the year. And last of all, the confusion around who is responsible is really the pertinent and what we're trying to take back to the NDIA. The medications one, this is a fraught space anyway with medications, because PBS and community pharmacy are Commonwealth funded programs. The state did put in place a few things to try and ensure continuity of medication access, but obviously this is an area that we can do much, much better, and that we have seen there are some clear gaps in planning and preparation. So those are particularly conversations that we want to have with the NDIA and at a state level with all of our groups. So I can't answer that today, but it's one of the most important ones to take back. So thank you.
Anyone else?
Oh, it's Heidi from Office for Disability. Mine was more of a comment around engaging advocacy organisations in some of the work that you're doing. And I was just going to advocate for including self-advocacy groups in that as well, because there's some really strong groups operating out of Gippsland that would have great insight into some of those informal social supports that are really valuable for people with cognitive disability. So I'd be happy to get you some names and details, but Adrian might have links there as well.
Great. Thank you. I think the community recovery groups that Bushfire Recovery Victoria are going to support the establishment of will go to communities and ask them to involve themselves and nominate, but we can certainly make that an explicit part of those conversations. Yeah, thank you. Hi, Adrian.
Yeah, good morning. My name's Adrian. I work with Gippsland Disability Advocacy. My role is the Executive Officer. Probably just more information sharing just for everyone's benefit. So we're the disability advocacy organisation funded to look after the Gippsland region. I'll just put into context, our funding and service agreement with the National Disability Advocacy Program is to work with 160 clients annually. With the Office for Disability, our funding and service targets are to work with 20 clients, so all up it's 180. So we had some presence at the Relief Centre. Put into context, on one day alone we picked up, began working with 19 new clients. And over the course of the next 2 days, we picked up 16 new clients. So it was, in effect, 35 new clients in 3 days. So you could really quickly see the challenges from the funding constraints when we're working with and having these crises. What I will say, and some of the learnings I think is really important, is the local intelligence and having people who are close to the area and working those areas is just pivotal in a crisis. I'll give an example. It's well documented, so I'm happy to share it. But there was a family of 10 that we began working with. This family, seven children have disabilities in the family of 10. They basically presented to one of the relief centres that we're at in Sale. The benefit of being local and really knowing our community was the fact that one of our advocates, Sam, was able to engage with the local grammar school. It's a Gippsland Grammar School, in January at that time of year. So they've got boarding rooming houses in there. So I was able to engage and advocate for there, where we were able to get that particular family in the grammar school, and they stay there for close to the full month of January. So you can imagine that, you know, a family that's been displaced with 10 children was always going to be difficult. But I think it's really imperative if we know our surrounds. So we worked across the three of the relief centres, Bensdale, Sale and Morwell, which was down the line. Essentially what ended up occurring was the Bensdale Relief Centre just became too big, and so there was more relief centres opened up down the line, down the highway towards Melbourne. With regards to the NDIA, what we found is they were surprisingly really of great benefit. They dropped a lot of the red tape for people impacted and started to release some of the shackles and help people who were in need. One real, very real issue that occurred was that particular office in Bensdale was closed for a number of days, predominantly because they had staff impacted. I think there's 6 staff in that office and 3 or 4 impacted themselves. So really difficult to have that office. So that, yeah, they were closed for a number of days, which was a bit of a problem, but we got through that. And look, just overwhelmingly, what I will say, a real learning out of this is also is to, I think for disability advocacy organisations is to, and all of us in the sector really, is to have strong, vibrant, and positive relationships with our peak bodies, because at times like this, our peak bodies have far greater capacity or influence to be able to talk to people within government to make some immediate or substantial changes. So, you know, we were lucky that we had really good support through VCOS, Victorian Council of Social Services. We also had really good support through DANA. Mary Mallett, some of you may know Mary. She's the CEO of Disability Advocacy Network Australia. So on the third day, so once we've picked up 19 clients and over the next 2 days, 16, I literally started getting really scared about how we're going to manage this, because the other thing was the unknown. We just don't know if we're going to be there for the month of January or is it just a couple of days. But yeah, those particular organisations have access into decision makers within government that we probably just don't have. So that was really important. And I think that's just a key message, is just to have those really strong engagement with those communities. The other thing, I'd just make a broad statement, was I reckon we received probably 10 to 15 contacts from different organisations just saying, hey, you're in Gippsland, we're thinking of you, we understand it must be really difficult at this point in time. And I just think the sector overwhelmingly just, you know, put their arms, wrapped them around us just to say if there's anything you guys need, which was really, really lovely. The other thing that we did, and I think it's important, was by having presence at the relief centre, just started to engage with the first port of call at the relief centre is Red Cross. So anyone who presents there for the first time need to go and get ticked off by Red Cross. It's just come to me now. So what was really important there is, as Red Cross, we're literally doing a tick off, asking 5 or 6 key questions. We're able to get them to adapt their intake form, for want of a better word, an intake form, and just to say, there's a disability advocate here. Are any members of your family, do they have a disability, and would you like to engage with a disability advocate? If so, literally, yes, yes, and then they just walked them straight across to us. So that's something that Red Cross had to just adapt, a minor change, and that was a positive. Because there's no use having the disability advocates in at a relief centre if nobody knows we're there. And that's the most important, was the intake situation. I'm happy to take any queries otherwise.
Could I just quickly acknowledge Adrian and your team? Not only they all live in the Gippsland area, they're all probably personally impacted by these bushfires, but right in the middle of it, they're out there in those centres helping people with disabilities. So really, thank you. Thank you for everything you've done.
I've been involved in the disability movement for about 30 years, and you would have thought there would be some already plans for. You know what I'm saying?
Plans. For our planning. I think what we find is that our planning is usually in response to an event we've just had, and our plans usually seem to relate to what has happened previously, and that there is always going to be something unknown in any new event. I think what we are keen to know is how planning has changed since the NDIA got involved, and certainly we're looking at how we can support better planning, because we don't have the same line of sight to what planning happens in communities and what planning happens for clients through the NDIS. It's an area we want to strengthen, absolutely. And Deb, correct me if I'm wrong, we're doing some work with Red Cross about how they can be doing more planning with clients and service users as well.
I'm Rosalie O'Neill, and I live in the Shire of Wellington. And I did go when we had the meeting at the airport when we were talking about emergency evacuation and disabled people. I wasn't involved. My mum was really sick, so I ended up going across to Perth on the 4th of January. But in Wellington, we have a fantastic council, and we'd actually done a test drive of the evacuation centre 2 years prior. So we had a really good idea of what to do and what was needed. The Red Cross were fantastic as an organisation, but we discovered that they needed training in that a lot of the way that they wanted to do the intake form was by handwriting, and we found that to be a very, very slow process. So the Red Cross in our area were trained to do to work better with computers. And we also learnt things about animals, where they could go. And I think that's really important that the councils do get on board and do these scenarios where you do actually give it a try, because we discovered things like everybody wanted access to power and cords and to charge their phones and... So there was a lot of bits and pieces that came out of it, and that our council, Cheryl McHugh, she has been huge in this area. She's been advocating for 10 years as a council staff member, that you really need to practice.
Thank you. We know that councils all do things slightly differently, and I think hearing of best practice examples are really helpful to take back. I know that Bridget, you would meet with MAV, and we meet with MAV also, with the Municipal Association of Victoria. The Municipal Association of Victoria, which is your local council peak body, I think, to talk about some of these, but that is a terrific case study that would be wonderful to take back in discussions with them and say this is how it can work. And that is something we have noticed, that places like Toowong, where the Shire is very small and were affected by fires, that they hadn't they struggled a lot themselves. They're there to provide support and information and advice, but also many of those staff were affected by the fires themselves, and they hadn't had a lot of previous experience with some of these events either. So it's something that we're well aware, having some further support and work for council members themselves. But that's a great story.
I'm going to be a bit cheeky, and I'm going to ask a question as me, Melissa, the deaf person, rather than me, Daru person, right? I live in the Yarra Valley, and I'm on a bushfire zone, and so we're always, at the back of our mind, there's always a worry, there's a bushfire, what do we do, blah, blah, blah. What worries me is those lands there. What is the NDI's role in supporting people doing evacuations and all that sort of stuff? I would hate to think the NDIA has any role in this, because if something happened to me or my family and I need to get out and I need to evacuate and everything, the idea of the NDIA having any involvement in this strikes fear. Because anything to do with the NDIS at the moment is just overcomplicated. So it's like, if a person without a disability needs to get out and they need help for some reason, like they need they're an asthmatic and they need an asthma puffer or something, someone will get them an asthma puffer and all is good. So if I need to get out and my implant gets lost in the fire and I need an Auslan interpreter, why can't people just make that happen? Why did it have to go through the NDIA to make sure my plan is activated so that someone can get me an Auslan interpreter? Why a separate thing?
Yep.
I just want to know, why is the NDIA involved in an emergency evacuation type thing? Why is it not just emergency management?
So they're not involved in emergency evacuation. It's more of the service continuity if there's been an emergency evacuation. But I think we're always trying to test and better understand exactly what role the NDIA have in the planning and in supporting clients either before or after. Certainly in an emergency and evacuation, you would be relying on police, on local councils, on emergency management sector, not on the NDIA. But there is, and I go back to the first question that we had about the role of the NDIA and the state and who's responsible. I think there is still that ongoing conversation to really be clear about what the responsibilities are and what the supports are and who can provide them best. So that would be what I say, Melissa. And I live in a bushfire zone too, so I absolutely hear what you're saying. You wouldn't want to depend on the NDIA to evacuate you at all. No.
Sorry, my final question, I promise. I'd also be really interested in continuing this conversation as well, keeping in touch. So I noted when you were talking before, you talked about the Vulnerable Persons Register.
Yes.
And whether that is appropriate for emergency situations. My understanding is that there's only 1,000 Victorians with disabilities on there, and that gets reviewed every 6 months. And I think there really needs to be another way of registering if you think you need support in an emergency, and what that support would look like and how that support would be best provided to you, and have additional funding waiting there if it needs to be made available to Victorians with disabilities. Sorry, that was more a comment than a question. I just think needs to be highlighted.
I think that is a consistent comment that we're hearing as well. And I know certainly that what the VPR, the Vulnerable Persons Register, doesn't do well is capture people who may need assistance some of the time. You know, they might be fine if their neighbour is home or their family is home, but when their family isn't there, then they need assistance. And how do we capture something that's episodic in nature rather than a binary thing of all the time or not any of the time? So that is something that in the review that we're doing this year, we would like to come back and speak to people about how we might have something else or something that works better, more fit for purpose. What I will do is send Melissa an email address that anyone can send any questions or comments or ideas or feedback to that Deb and I monitor, and we can always come back to you and continue talking to you throughout the year as we progress any of this work, if that would be helpful.
PowerPoint and everything is always available on our website anyway, as well as the recording from this session as well. So
great. Thank you.
Any last question before we break early? Or comments or stories or anything you want to contribute? No?
Thank you all very much for your time and attention and for your input. It's been really helpful for us, and we really hope to keep hearing from you and working with you all. And thank you so much for all of your work.
Thank you very much, Tanya, for taking the time to share what is happening, and also to all of you for sharing your thoughts and stories as well. We're going to break a bit early. Lunch won't be ready until about 12 o'clock, so you've got about 15 minutes to chat amongst yourselves, and then we'll come back here at 1 o'clock for the next session. So thank you, everyone.